Welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz on the mouth, Maraca. That's what Adam was laughing at. I did the chaka, chaka. It's our favorite song, so...
Clearly, it's our theme music.
Exactly.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can listen to us live online, too. Just go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen, and you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast on Podbean, iTunes, or Stitcher. Today, we will look at the results of the provincial election in British Columbia, where Liberal Premier Christy Clark secured a razor-thin margin of victory that has still yet to be verified by Elections BC. So what can those of us in Ontario take away from this election, looking ahead to our own provincial showdown in just 1 year? Then we will welcome back Ward 1 Councillor Dan Gibson to Open Sources, and we will catch up with him on some of the issues presently before City Hall and Council, including Gibson's upcoming motion to encourage the city to move to a more carbon-neutral footing, and we'll also talk about affordable housing, commercial development, and whatever else comes up. But first, we had have another NDP visitor in town this past weekend. It was NDP MP and leadership candidate Nikki Ashton, and she was at Red Papaya in Old Quebec Street this past Sunday. Both Scotty and I were there to hear her get the local members riled up. And...
They marched downtown, then they took noise. Yeah.
It was after dinner on Sunday. There wasn't going to be much marching, but she's a very, I think, exciting figure in the party because she's younger and she's very in tune with the
loss of energy considering
with
the
progressive
tour
side. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she got at least 30 people, if not more, out to see her on a Sunday evening, which was fairly impressive and pretty good turnout. But before that, I did get the chance to talk to her in an interview that I also recorded to play on the show right now. So I will turn that over to me 6 days ago, and we'll hear what Nikki Ashton has to say and be right back. As I was just saying, you're the third NDP leadership candidate to come to Guelph. I think Guy Caron was up in Waterloo last week. So it's definitely in the area, I suppose. But speaking for yourself, what do you think makes Guelph an essential stop, it seems, for NDP leadership candidates and also for yourself in particular?
Well, we're now doing the Southern Ontario portion of our tour, and a number of activists from Guelph reached out to us and invited us to come. And you know, I've worked with people from Guelph over the years and gotten to know activists from here, and you know, I'm aware that there's a lot of progressive energy in this community, and we wanted to come out and obviously share our message of building a movement for social, environmental, and economic justice together.
Mm-hmm. I don't, just from my own observation, you're talking about sort of like the whole package of social and economic justice, and it seems like Charlie Angus was here. He was talking in particular about Indigenous issues and Indigenous rights, and when Nathan Cullum is here, his talk was specifically about electoral reform, but that does seem to be his beat.
Yes, but he's not running.
Right.
Yeah, that is his beat.
It does seem like you guys kind of compartmentalize yourselves into your little... not even official portfolios, but, you know.
Yeah.
Is that a fair assessment? Do you think you're each bringing something, like a different focus area as you're sort of on the trail?
I'm not sure I could speak to the focuses the others are choosing, certainly those that are running, but, our campaign is very much about getting the NDP back on track. Mm-hmm. What I've said is the NDP's at a crossroads. The 2015 election was a very difficult one, and it was one where we distanced ourselves from our principles and allowed ourselves to be outlefted by the Liberals. So we need to reconnect with those left principles, reconnect with the sense that we are a movement. That's part of who we've been historically. Reconnect with activists and community leaders who share our values and are fighting for the same things we're fighting for. But we also need to be very clear about the big issues that the big challenges that we face as Canadians, and those are growing inequality and the threat of climate change. Mm-hmm. And what we're saying is that there needs to be a progressive platform to take these challenges on, and it requires a movement, and And yes, it has to be comprehensive. It has to be on taking on a progressive approach on various fronts, whether it's social justice, environmental justice, or economic justice.
And you don't see a rift in the party, because that's coming up a bit. And Charlie Syndicate is kind of maybe a media sort of puppet kind of conspiracy, or not a conspiracy, but a controversy, that there's this impassable divide in the NDP between, you know, sort of blue-collar working class of, like, people who are affected, whether or not there's, like, jobs on the oil patch, and then the more progressive wing of the party who have their minds very focused on not just the economic affairs and putting people to work, but the social justice causes, mm-hmm. and identity politics and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's that rift is sort of been a false narrative, or do you think that maybe there are some places that the party does need to work on, for lack of a better word, reconciliation between the two halves?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that what we need to do is learn from what happened in the last election where we played it too safe. We distanced ourselves from our principles. You know, we need to be a strong voice for working people, for people struggling in poverty and on the margins. And we need to be serious about the challenges ahead. You know, when we're talking about inequality in Canada, you know, we often talk about how we're better than the U.S. or we're different from the U.S. So back to the beginning of the question. You know, I believe what we need to do as the NDP is learn from the 2015 election, particularly the way in which we played it too safe, allowed the Liberals to outlift us, and at a time when we've got major challenges ahead, we need to take very seriously the challenge of growing inequality in our country, the threat of climate change, and that requires working together across the country, west, east, north, south, and I think there's a lot of shared values, not only shared values, but also a real sense that we need to work together, because these challenges, whether it is inequality, whether it is climate change, are so significant, we can't waste time.
You say that the NDP the party allowed itself to be outflanked on the left by the Liberals. Does that mean to say you think that the Liberals were playing the part of being more progressive than they really are?
Yes. That's exactly what I mean. Yes. Yeah, I do believe that the Liberals in many ways lied to Canadians, whether it was on electoral reform, on pipelines and environmental policy, whether it was even on marijuana legislation, which, you know, we've yet to see that come into play, and even the proposed legislation does not actually reflect the spirit of what was promised to Canadians. But on something as fundamental as jobs and addressing the disappearing middle class, addressing the fact that more and more young people are facing precarious work, the Liberals, not only have they not been there to be part of the solution, they are governing in such a way that inequality is certainly going to grow by promoting privatization of our transportation assets, for example, by promoting bad trade deals, and by failing to invest in good jobs and certainly even green jobs as well.
Mm-hmm. You did mention the U.S., and that is sort of like the elephant in every room these days, it feels like. And I'm glad you mentioned about your feelings on the Liberals, because I had heard you say something to that effect before. And then I wrote down the question, how do we get from there to here? Here being where we have truly progressive values in the government, that there being a lot of lip service, because I think people are almost satisfied by the lip service, it seems, that as long as somebody's sort of sounding different than our friend in the White House right now, then that's enough, because that sound of the current president of the United States is almost deafening to, I think, anyone with any small percentage of progressive values, that just paying lip service seems to be enough now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, I think, what we had was, 10 years of a right-wing, divisive government, the likes, of which we hadn't seen before, certainly in the way Harper governed, and people were angry, they were exhausted, they were frustrated, they were beaten down, and we did see record activism, resistance emerge, and people wanted change, I'm proud of the work that the NDP did in the lead up to getting rid of Harper, but unfortunately in that election too many many people ended up seeing the Liberals represent change. And you know, obviously, and people believed the message. And, you know, why wouldn't they? It was a hopeful message. In many cases, it was a progressive message, whether it was on door-to-door delivery or like I said, on the environment, you know, and on promise after promise, particularly the more progressive sounding ones, they've broken those promises or they've simply failed to act. And you know, I think you're starting to see the shine come off. People are saying, you know, we didn't vote for a government that was going to break their promises on key issues like this. You know, and I'm certainly seeing, particularly on electoral reform, people be very upset. And so, you know, and I like I said, I mean, I think what is clear right now is the direction, you know, that we're going into. The challenges of inequality, of climate change are so significant. Mm-hmm. The stakes are too high not to be involved. You know, the Conservatives in their race, you know, we see a race that's been inspired by Trump-like politics and Trump-like mm-hmm. ideas, and they're going to be taking the direction, our country into an even more dangerous direction. It's not just right-wing, but, you know, alt-right influenced. I'm certainly worried about that. And then the other option is Justin Trudeau, who, like I said, is not just overseeing the rise in inequality, but encouraging it through his economic policies. And so the question is, you know, who's going to stand up for working people? Who's going to stand up for people in poverty? And who's going to stand up to the system that's holding us further and further back? And I believe that's the NDP.
Are you relieved that the Conservative race is almost over? Because maybe that'll get a bit more attention to the NDP race, because I feel like the NDP race has kind of been smothered by the blue race, it seems.
You know, I mean, I certainly welcome the opportunity to find out more about what the Conservative candidates believe in, because I think, you know, public relations exercise can hide the extremes in that race, I'm certainly looking forward to seeing who the leader is, so we have a sense of you know, where that party might be going. But regardless, I mean, it's clear to me that race has been shaped in many ways by the kind of political dynamics to the south of us, you know. And I mean, our race is still at the relatively early stages. You know, I'm certainly seeing a lot of people that are engaged on the ground in communities across the country. I've been put over 6,000 kilometers in the prairies and now in Ontario. And I expect that things will continue to build.
Couldn't somebody say the same thing about you in terms of being inspired by what's happened south? You were very famously a Bernie supporter.
Yes. I wear the badge proudly. Yeah, huge fan of Bernie Sanders. You know, many people in my generation and many Canadians were inspired by what he did. And I absolutely believe there's lots we should be learning from what he did and the movement he built.
Sure.
You know, this was somebody who brought forward some very progressive policies. You know, he was unabashedly identified as a socialist, has made a life of speaking truth to power. And we saw the way in which people mobilized around his campaign's message, and to me that is where we need to be going. I think, in fact, I think that Canada is perhaps more fertile ground for a Bernie type message. But I believe that the time is now to bring that kind of progressive politics and movement building to our country, and I'm certainly excited to be part of that.
In terms of your own case for leadership, I'm going to ask you, first of all, what you think makes you the best choice for leader. But on top of that, I also want to hear from you what might make the others in the race a good choice for NDP leader.
Well, I'll start with that question. I mean, every single one of the other candidates are my colleagues. I have tremendous respect for them. I've worked with them, some of them as long as I've been an MP, for almost, 9 years, and one of them a bit less since he became an MP. And I've been very proud to work with them. They've been some of the strongest voices on the issues that we've been fighting for, on the front lines of key struggles in our country, and I would certainly be pleased to work with any one of them if they were to become leader. You know, they share obviously a commitment and a passion for the party that many of us share. But I have no doubt that that they would work hard and that together we could do great work. In terms of our campaign, what our campaign has been saying is that this is an opportunity to be principled, to be proud of being the left party, to be a clear voice for people on the margins, for working people, and to stand up to the rich and powerful who have been holding us back. As a millennial, I don't just talk about young people, I talk with young people. This is my generation. And when you look at what inequality looks like in our country, for the first time in our history, it's intergenerational. You know, when you have a generation where a growing number of young people in our country are saying that they will live lives worse off than their parents, that statement is chilling. It's not fitting of a country as wealthy as Canada in 2017. And you see it from the latest job numbers, you see it in our communities, you hear about it anecdotally. And I'm very passionate about the fact that the NDP can be the best party to fight for the issues of not just young people but all generations when it comes to inequality, but that we have to do it. The time is now.
And that was NDP leadership candidate Nikki Ashton, and we recorded that interview at the Red Papaya before the meeting started, and so that's why you got a little Oasis there, a little Top 40.
Ambiance.
It's ambiance. Which is
get the feel of old Quebec Street Mall. Yes,
ambiance in the same sentence. I think that goes without saying, and I think we've had like half the slate come to town now.
Might actually be a full sweep if we keep it up. And although with Jagmeet Singh entering the race,
has he entered?
I believe so. Or sorry, is it's one of those strong rumors but not confirmed?
Okay, I haven't heard.
Oh, I think he's in. This is the worst kept secret in the country at this point. But
well, he.
They had a picture of him doing like kung fu in the.
He's already won best dress. So.
Yeah, oh yeah, I think so.
Anyway,
look out, Justin! Here comes Jagmeet. Anyway, that's topic for another day.
We have to talk about now. Well, I don't know if we have to, but we decided to.
Yes, we have to.
The BC provincial election happened this past Tuesday, and it was very, very close. It was kind of expected to be close, but not this close. Just to break down the vote by the percentages, the Liberals got 40.85%, the NDP got 39.85%, and then the Greens got 16.74%. And how that translates right this minute is 43 seats for the Liberals, 41 seats for the NDP, and 3 seats for the Green. So they needed 44 seats to have a 50% plus one majority. The Liberals and Christy Clark presently do not have that. So the Greens are in the unusual position of holding the balance of power for the first time in Canadian politics.
Incredible.
It is incredible. There is the one caveat is that there is absentee ballots and that have to be counted on. I think that's happening on the May 22nd through 24th. And then there's also recounts because according to the law in BC, if you win by 0.2% or less, you have to do a recount by law. So.
And of course, the recount everybody's watching with bated breath, I guess, is what was it, Courtney Comox? Nine vote difference.
That was the name of the riding, too. That wasn't the name of the candidate.
Hi, I'm Courtney Comox. Courtney-Comox is the riding. 9 votes. So I think.
And it was a Liberal who won by 9 votes. So if that, if they do the recount there and it's like the NDP actually wins by 1 vote, that means that the NDP or the Liberals sort of lose another seat, and it's tied 42-42.
And, of course, all the pollsters breathe the sigh of relief this time because last time they got so incredibly wrong, and this time they pretty much nailed it. So I guess some faith is restored there because when they were, I think it was Grenier was talking about it, Eric Grenier from the CBC, who is, I would probably say, Canada's top go-to pollster in these things, was talking about the numbers and how it was neck and neck. His prediction was like 39. It was pretty much 40 for the NDP, 40 for the Liberals, give or take a few points, and the Greens at 18. So pretty much on the mark there. And I thought, wow, wouldn't that be interesting if it was that close that the Greens held the balance of power? And that's what happened. It's like, whoa. This is unprecedented. And they said they hadn't had a minority since 1952.
It's been a while.
When BC votes, they really, you know, do a solid on their governments. But yeah, so this the part I don't know is why did they wait so long for the absentee ballots? I mean, I guess normally in a normal election when it's a clear majority, perhaps the absentee ballots don't matter as much. But this time, 176,000. Right. So that's everybody just further afield and the military, I guess. And
yeah, people who weren't going to be in town for the election. I don't know. That's a good question. And maybe just because it matters all the more for a change, that what's going to be in those ballots and how there were so many slim margins and how it might swing the margin. And that's perhaps why it matters so much this time.
Yeah, and I think what happens in these cases, too, I mean, obviously the courtship of the Greens is probably fast and furious behind the scenes. It's like Liberals will be like, please support us. And of course, the NDP will, too. It sounds like policy-wise, they have more in common with the NDP, specifically their view on the pipelines, both coming from Alberta and Kinder Morgan, and also the people may not know this, but BC is a bit of a Wild West in terms of contributions from corporations and unions, and the NDP have come out completely against that, and so have the Greens. So in terms of alignment, the stars aligning, Greens and the NDP have a lot in common and could very well decide to have some kind of, if not a proper coalition, then one of those sort of tacit agreements where it's like, okay, we'll support you. But I think in this case, they probably would have to ink it, I guess, because they have sort of anointed Christy Clark's Liberals as the government, although technically and officially they're not really.
Right.
They are. She's still the premier.
I think
but
they've
officially.
Asked, yeah, I think they've asked the Lieutenant General to recognize the Liberals as the government for a couple of weeks until
the hard numbers
until,
come out.
Yeah, until the final count is done. Mm-hmm. I believe Andrew Weaver, who's the leader of the Greens, I think he was a federal Liberal. I might have heard that wrong. I didn't dig too much into his background politics, but I think so. That could be another sign that perhaps he might be, he could align himself with Christy Clark. Of course, it's worth noting that what's Liberal in BC is not necessarily what's Liberal on the federal level or what we would consider Liberal in Ontario.
Yeah, because
the Liberals are very much the Conservative Party in BC.
In everything, probably, but name only. There's sort of a coalition, I guess, of Liberal, PC, and others. But, of course, this is
Blue Tories.
This is the province that had
Tories.
Social credit for, I guess Alberta had social credit as well. But people say, social what? For years and years, they had this government that was definitely right-leaning, but they weren't conservatives and were the government several times in BC until they kind of fizzled. And out of that movement came the Mannings, including Preston Manning, who, of course, you know, has eventually reformed and then...
Yeah.
And now he's an institute, I guess. The Manning Institute.
Well, he has an institute with his name.
Broadbent and everybody else.
Some people would probably call him an institution.
He probably is at this point. So
I did find the breakdown in terms of the geography interesting, because if you look at the electoral map, it's kind of this big orange block along the coastline. And then in through Vancouver, that's where it's kind of all orange, and then it's all red.
The orange tsunami, is that what they're
calling? Well,
not
I don't
quite,
know.
Eh?
But then it's definitely orange from the Alberta border to central BC, and then down on Vancouver Island, on the tip of Vancouver Island, the southern tip of Vancouver Island, that's green zone. So it seems it's very geographical too, the divide. There's kind of a political and geographical divide.
But, is that where Saanich Gulf Islands is as well? Like that is a hotbed, I guess, if that's where Elizabeth May's seat is. So they're probably.
I'm not from too terribly familiar with BC geography,
so
but it would make
away.
Sense because that is kind of officially now Elizabeth May territory. She's won it twice, so.
And three seats.
Yeah.
That's, have I got it right that Weaver, did he run as a Greener or did he convert? I'm not, we probably should know this. So, like, he was I just have it in my head that he was, like, he...
Saying he's a convert?
He's a convert.
Sort of makes me
wonder. Green, and then now there's three.
One thing I do know is that Christy Clark won her riding by like 60%, which is an interesting change of pace for her, because in the 2013 election, she had to run in a by-election.
I'm sure people from BC that are listening there now in Guelph are saying, oh, those guys don't. Yes, Sanish is definitely near Victoria. I've been to Victoria, but it was a long, long, like a really long time ago. Actually, it was for a Green Party thing. But it was on the mainland. But anyway, things have changed since then. My goodness. And I'm no longer in the Green Party. I haven't been for years, by the way. So, it's possibly the most interesting election we've had for a while. And it will be also interesting to see who the Greens align with, because I think if they go, one of the comments I heard, which I sort of agreed with, was if they align themselves with the Liberals, then people just say, oh, it's obvious. They were Liberals anyway. This has been said about Elizabeth May lots of times, that she's just very obviously a Liberal in Green clothes.
Well,
not completely, but, I guess if they have to choose and they do side with the Liberals, then it'll be... The vision, it won't be changed. It'll be kind of like, well, it's a bit more of the same if they're siding.
What's fascinating about the Green, at least the federal Green Party, is that it's kind of center-right. It gets painted as being loony left because it's pro-environment. But a lot of people in the Green Party are like former PCs, former red Tories.
Yep.
So look, Gord Miller, who ran here in the last federal election, the Green Party candidate, was appointed by Mike Harris as the environmental commissioner. He ran as a PC candidate. So
and Jim Harris, who ran the party for years, was ex-conservative as well.
Absolutely.
Throughout the 90s, I guess.
So it would make sense that they were to align with the Liberals. But I think... I think...
If they really want change, if they're going to be the change makers.
That's what I was going to do. If it's going to be about change, then they have to align with the NDP. And as the Tai pointed out, that like 60% of people in this election voted for change. So voted for NDP or Green or someone else, Libertarian or whoever. Everybody else got like 2% of the vote. So.
Yeah, because they also had the highest vote increase. Like Liberals and NDP kind of stayed the same at around that 40% number. The Greens went up 8.4%, effectively doubling their popular vote.
And when you take into account that the Liberals have been in power in BC 16 years, it's a tired party.
Yeah.
Perhaps needing a bit of a change up. And certainly Christy Clark was, and this may be arguable to an extent, but some people perceive Christy Clark as playing very much like the Tai compared her to acting Trump. Like, I wouldn't go that far, but she definitely kind of had that, like, well, I've been the premier, so, like, why is everybody questioning me, and why is...
And yet I happened to see the commercial, one of the commercials out of BC with the lightning bolts and Trump's head appearing, and it's like there's only one person that can handle Trump, and that's Christy Clark. I'm like, whoa,
yeah that's
just scare people into like, oh my God, Trump's coming. But yeah, he's gonna block the softwood into the. There was lots of campaigning and pictures of Christy Clark with the high vis vest on, hard hat, standing with piles of wood.
Yeah,
I think that was her way of saying we're gonna get this wood somewhere. Whether it's to the south or other markets, let's say.
Of course, BC is like sort of ground zero for that, because not only is it where the softwood lumber, but it's also American coal gets sent over the border in trucks and put on ships in BC to head to China. American coal, and of course, Donald Trump has made it a key platform to preserve and expand and defend coal country in the United States. So it's a bit closer to home than if we were to see something like that run in Ontario. It's certainly more apt, but it is interesting that she got it kind of both sides from the Trump coin, where she was compared to Trump and she's cast herself as someone who is a Trump fighter.
It's a very liberal thing to do, in my opinion.
Well, the liberal thing to do now would be to take a break and play some music.
It's a hot one, folks.
Yeah, it's a little warm in the studio. We're in that dull area where they're trying to switch over from.
Construction season has begun.
Yeah, so. But they're switching over from the heat to the AC. So yeah. We will take a break now and then bring in our special guest, who is Ward 1 City Councilor Dan Gibson. You are listening to Open Source as Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Medicina, chequere, dice, chequere, chequere, que no pare el chequere, dice, chequere, chequere, suena rico el chequere, 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 que no pare el chequere, 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 suena rico el chequere.
And that was Alex Cuba from his album New Into the Station. I hope I don't blow this. Lo Único Constante. Everything's
right.
In Spanish. It sounds all right, yeah. And that was Chequere, which is actually the drum that is playing in that song. That beat is being made by Chequere. You learn something every day. It's not just at CFRU, but on this very show. So
that's all right. We'll forget
Chequere that album out. And there you go.
Save the puns for when Phil's on.
You're the pun man. I'll leave it to you.
So we are pleased to welcome back City Councilor Dan Gibson from Ward 1. From what I gather, it was a close shave. You were in traffic until very recently.
It's kind of hairy out there today. Yeah, 401 was a bit slow. There's a couple of different ways to get into town, and then obviously we're under construction here at the University Center. So
construction. Yes.
Thank goodness for nice, friendly people here on campus to help me upstairs. So
it's like a Super Mario game in here. worse than that, you were in Ottawa till last night. You were on. Not with city council business, but for your day job with OPG.
Yeah, I was. Some of my day-to-day work with on the hydroelectric side, I chair a few committees for the Canadian Hydropower Association. And as many who are probably listening know, the federal government has promised to review the Federal Fisheries Act, Canadian Environmental Assessment Act, and Navigable Waters Protection Act. So a lot of our advocacy work right now is kind of rolling up our sleeves and trying to help them get to some of those campaign promises and make sure that the policy is still workable, but still meets the test of sort of what the public demand of environmental regulations in Canada. So it's an exciting time to be working with the government on that file. And that's not Guelph business, but that is sort of my exciting work in natural resources. So.
Well, there are a lot of people here who do care about the waterways.
Is Guelph? I define it as energy and environment. If you're okay on those issues, then you can have great conversations here. So,
for sure. Well, you're looking to generate some conversation coming up, and I know you wanted to talk about this. Your motion on getting City Hall carbon neutral.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
In terms of where the city is right now on. You know, clean energy and being as environmentally friendly as possible with the fleet vehicles and just with city facilities. Where are we now with that? And in terms of getting close to where you want to go, and what made you want to bring this motion now?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, it's important to point out that our community energy initiative has been endorsed by council. That's with the task force right now. But that is the community side. So there are many different elements to this clean energy sort of renewable approach. We also have a corporate energy initiative, which is something that corporately we are working towards. And we've just struck a new climate change office. So we're looking to give them instruction, give them a mandate, give them new goals collectively as a council. Now, I've pulled the motion simply because of procedurally other councillors would like me to bring it forward through committee, which as the chair I'm allowed to do. So I'll be doing that hopefully next month. But this is really just fresh direction, a new goal, a pragmatic goal on our corporate side. So, for many years, the argument around climate change and initiatives has been solely focused on this moral need, this moral imperative to do something about climate change. And I get that. I get that language. I understand the volatility in global temperatures is something that we need to take seriously. But equally so, now with this rapidly evolving clean energy sector, you know, there's an equal argument fiscally to pursue these technologies and get on board. I the simplest way I can do it is sort of illustrated is in our household. My wife and I, in the last year, have made two investments in lighting alone. $200 investments twice, so a total of $400 we've invested. The payback period on those new LED lights from 100 watts down to 8 watts is about 8 months. Mm-hmm. So in 8 months, the energy savings we'll have just from the lighting alone will be paying us back. In 16 months, we'll have $800 back in our pocket.
Right.
And we can do more energy retrofits in our home that way. So it's kind of creating like this snowball effect. And that's really just what it comes down to with this net zero. Many people don't know, but again, corporately, I'm very protective of property rights and the ability of people to make their own choices in this sector. Mm-hmm. But corporately, our energy bill last year, our utility bill alone was $10 million. This year, it will be $10 million.
Right.
So the fiscal side of me says, I want to get at that budget. I want to go after it. And I see a path for a 40% reduction in our energy bill. That's $4 million that we can put towards other things, taking the pressure off taxpayers, but we can also apply it to some of our needed areas of spending, which is infrastructure.
Right.
So there's ways to fund infrastructure that I'm excited about. Likewise, on the vehicle fleet, I just had staff help me with this yesterday. We have a $4 million fuel charge corporately.
Right.
Transit and the fleet vehicles that we run. I know of technology now, this electric vehicle and the rapid adoption of technologies, where we can see a pathway to 75% reduction in our energy use on fuel alone. And when we're talking about a $4 million fuel budget, if it goes down to $1 million worth of electricity use for our fleets,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's another $3 million there that, again, the fiscal side of me says, let's go get it. So the investments don't scare me. Mm-hmm. Because we're buying vehicles every year. We have a procurement policy where we're retiring vehicles. And this, again, just getting on the train of these technologies, the moral imperative is decided. I completely accept that. But the fiscal argument now, we can get to through proper business planning and simple business cases, we can achieve these things. And something that I've been speaking about a little bit on council is that there is a common currency if we get these policies right. The common currency between where your priorities are. Is your priority an environment? Is it social? Is it fiscal? I think that if we get these policies right, we can increase the broad acceptance of these policies. So if you want to say you don't really care about the environment, I don't think there's many people left. But if some people say that, right? I think if
they're
someone,
very brave
that's
in this
right.
town, right?
But if they wanted that, right? If they said the only thing that matters to me is the return on investment, I can show you that value in these policies with this fiscal reporting, with this fiscal approach to bringing it forward. If your value is environment and you don't care mm-hmm. what it costs,
right?
I'll show you that your value can be presented in these policies. So that's really what I'm trying to get to with this net zero motion. The technologies exist. Environmentally, you'll see your values in these policies because we're going to tackle our carbon footprint. We're going to do our part in terms of a city. But economically, it doesn't have to be all or nothing anymore. We can attack this from a very stable position and within a 5-10 year window. Corporately, again, the community energy side I'm leaving to the task force, but corporately, I know our climate change office is excited for potentially getting this direction. So I'm looking to gain support. I believe it's there on council, and we're just going to dialogue and we're going to make it sharp. So
I would be very surprised if it wasn't there, but I did note, I looked at your website at the original motion, and it's very pragmatic. You mm-hmm. you make a point of saying this is a pragmatic motion. This is not
That's
aspirational,
right.
like with
That's right.
like with the community energy.
So we've fallen into that trap before,
right?
As a city, and I acknowledge that, you know, when the vision of district energy and when the vision of 50% less energy use comes out of a politician's mouth,
mm-hmm.
it's easy to get caught up in that. What is hard is the implementation,
right.
and getting it right. So I'm very hesitant. I'm always hesitant to not oversell. My policies and my positions on vision, because vision ultimately can let people down. And I think on the green energy side of things, whether it be in Guelph, whether it be provincial, the implementation has fallen short. I think that it's consensus that we haven't done the implementation well enough.
Mm-hmm.
And the vision's easy, but it's the implementation that I'm excited to bring to the table, and I'm excited to show people the fiscal outcomes that we can have through good, strong, sort of eco-fiscal policies.
Right. But when we're talking about community and district energy, I do wonder what those initial conversations were like. I don't think anyone from that time was saying, we're just going to throw out a number and we're going to meet that number through our plan of magic and wonder. And I'm just, part of this has to be aspirational, though. I mean, I understand the pragmatism is how you get people, it's how you get from point A to B. But I mean,
absolutely. So the aspirational, I will confess, the aspirational is great. We want that kind of aspirational thoughts and desires from our community. But where we have to temper expectations is how fast we can get there and what it will take to get there. Again, I'm leaving this for another time, but I really believe that if I can be honest, you know, the fiscal side of the house has largely deferred leadership on the environment for about 10, 15 years now.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to change that perception. I'm excited to change that perception. But I think the policy where maybe the fiscal side of the house is strong is the implementation. And we can help. So we need to table motions and table recommendations that we all accept and then allow that sort of mutual leadership to take where you're balancing the vision and you're also balancing that fiscal approach. Mm-hmm. A commission that I followed for a while is the Ecofiscal Commission. It started, it's a national commission. It's got broad-based support from former prime ministers, from all parties. It has a good, strong representation. And when they started, they really started on this approach where we are going to form our policies based on environmental initiatives, strong on the environment, but also strong fiscally. And they're going to bring those two together to, again, create that common currency, which I love referring to because it's easy for people to understand.
Right.
Yeah.
You can get the people from the pro-environment side because it's about finding solutions, and you get the people who are this from the skeptical side who may agree that we need to do something about the environment but have seen sort of dreams come apart in the reality of a...
Yeah, so I'm sensitive to both sides.
Yeah.
I know because I have a lot of people in my ward that it's the important part of their position is getting the environment right.
In the ward?
Yeah, moving forward with these great policies, which I fully accept that is their priority, that's their passion. I want to harness that, but I am also sensitive to the people that have been let down.
Yeah,
quite frankly, by some of the sort of files that we've pursued.
Mm-hmm.
To be polite in Guelph, I've been very passionate about just the way we have perhaps broken some trust on some of the things that the council has pursued, or even, again, the province. And we need to restore that confidence in people that the leaders are making those decisions based on sound economics as well as ambitious climate change goals.
Mm-hmm. You are diplomatic, I'll give you that.
I really do try.
Hopefully you'll be diplomatic again, because we do want to get to a couple of other issues. And one of them is...
You're going to take me to e-voting, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah, of course you are. We have to go there, yes.
You read my mind. Because it did seem it got pretty political there.
Of course.
It did seem that there was a camp of, like, the people who are concerned about security, I think were very... you know, we're on the side of people who do want the accessibility side of it, but it did seem like the people who wanted the online voting saw people as kind of like chicken. I think I used the term Chicken Little in one of my Guelph Today columns.
Yeah,
and that's you know, that seems kind of reactionary. But I do wonder though, do you think maybe there was a way, I mean, hindsight being 2020, of course, but was there a way that we could have married the two, like use security,
yes,
keep one
absolutely.
Eye on security, yeah. And then let people have the accessibility side? Yeah.
So from the start, I'll say I'm still very disappointed in the way that whole thing ended, that file. We should, for accessibility reasons alone, we should have online voting in our city. And I see that as a failure of this council, but I accept the decision that was made. To the point, you know, for only the second time in the last 20 years, we had 40% plus turnout in our city for a municipal election. Now, it was a hotly contested election, but 6% above. We were 6% above the average 20 years. The average, the 20-year average in our city for turnout, we blew that away by 6%. Mm-hmm. We had 44% turnout, 10% more than we had in 2010. Some wanted to say that that had nothing to do with online voting, but I completely beg to differ, and I'm nervous.
No, I think that had a lot to do with online voting.
That's right. So to know that we are losing representation. So a quote that I love is Dr. Nicole Goodman, who, by the way, came 4 years ago or 6 years ago now and gave the exact opposite testimony that we heard over and over again. Mm-hmm. She came and talked about security. She came and talked about the validity and the value in going to online voting. And she's studying these. So Ajax is now 100% online. Sarnia is 100% online.
Right.
Markham has been running online voting for years. No problems. No security issues. But, you know, her quote was the largest reasons that she's seeing for skeptics when it comes to e-voting is that when you allow e-voting, you're bringing new voters to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of elected officials, that scares them. And so that narrative is real. It was struck. I was part of that striking of that narrative because it's important that we acknowledge that this is a very polarizing issue, but it's very political as well. And at the core, when all that washed away, right? So the mayor backed off, I backed off, everyone backed down, and we just started talking about what the core issue was here. And the core issue is, and the testimonies were wonderful from the Accessibility Advisory Committee, that we're shutting people out, right? By taking away online voting, we are shutting people out, and we know that. And I don't know that we're going to have the procedures in place to capture them in the next election.
Right.
That scares me, because I know that those people really valued their opportunity to contribute. So, and it goes beyond physical limitations. It goes to, you know, we heard from people who are afraid of big crowds. We heard from people who are agoraphobic, who are staying at home, deal with stress. We know these mental issues that are now not stigmat anymore, that we want to make sure that are coming out. I'm nervous that they're going to be lost in the next election, but I hope that the next council has this exact same debate, and whoever's on it, I hope they get it right next time.
I do wonder, I know Hugh Whiteley made the point that this maybe should have been a bit of a bigger discussion.
Well, thank you. So I thank you for teeing me up on that one, Adam.
Okay. Because been doing this a while now.
Yeah, so the mayor was missing at committee, and we had a committee meeting, and the motion was to recommend increasing online voting.
Right.
The recommendation from staff. And within 30 minutes, that motion had been changed from expanding online voting to getting rid of it altogether.
Yeah.
And I actually questioned whether or not that amendment was completely counter to the original recommendation and whether or not it was even valid. Because it was such short notice. And within 30 minutes, we are leaving City Hall saying, how do we tell our constituents that this is gone now? And in 2 weeks, it's going to be ratified. And how do we help them understand what's happening? Mm-hmm. And that was part of the blitz that went out about getting people aware of what's happening at City Hall and getting those emails coming in. You're right. Dr. Whiteley, rightfully so. If this was an intention to do it, right? And I didn't know that it was coming when we were at committee.
Right.
If it was an intention to do it, it should have been more properly approached.
Right.
Where we had more notification so we could have perhaps Dr. Nicole Kidman come back.
Sure.
Goodman, sorry, not Kidman.
Nicole, I was going to say. She's a doctor now. Yeah.
We'd love to have Nicole Kidman in town.
That's right. But, you know, it could have been dealt with better.
Yeah. It struck me as, I don't think it was anyone's fault in particular, because I think that on staff's part, on Stephen O'Brien's part, I don't think he anticipated the blowback.
I don't think he knew. I don't think he knew the amendment was coming.
Right.
His recommendation. Yeah.
And the flip side of it too, you're talking about Dr. Goodman talking about this 6 years ago, but 6 years in computer terms is an eon.
That's fair. Yep.
This is sort of a weird thing I've been struggling with, too. I see the security concern. I'm not worried about Russia meddling in Guelph's election. I'm worried about somebody who's like a Joker figure. Who's
trying to have a good time.
Right.
Yep. And I mean, perhaps I have a little bit more faith in the ability of someone to do that in a very short window.
Yeah.
Keep in mind that cybersecurity is going on all the time during the election. And when
Absolutely.
It shuts down, I was open to the idea that Councillor Downer brought forward, whereby we wouldn't expand it through the weekend mm-hmm. up until the day of the election. So we would shut it off on the Friday so that staff would have the weekend to really analyze.
Yeah.
You know, is there anything looking fishy here? Do we need to raise any flags? Which was what happened in the last election where they had that window.
Mm-hmm.
I was open to having that sort of compromise away from the recommendation from staff, but we didn't get there.
And there's also the very tight deadline from the province.
Yes, there was.
So. Yeah. We have just a couple of minutes left, but I do want to revisit one of your previous motions, about the commercial policy. I do wonder how that is going, because there was a pretty fierce debate about that, too, about that causing some cross-rift of expectation among developers. So
yep.
in terms of has there been any nibbles, or how has that turned out?
Yeah, so I think maybe setting the stage for the whole East End argument is appropriate. We have a problem. We have a monopoly-owned property in the East End that mm-hmm. most residents are already driving to one of the stores that the owner of the property owns. I don't begrudge them for what they're doing, but what I do say is that competition can solve a lot of this.
Mm-hmm.
And my whole argument through the campaign, through the election, and ever since I got elected was York Road is a path forward for our community. Redeveloping York Road. I have a lot of support from the store owners that are on York Road now mm-hmm. to do this. But then also there is some commercial properties on there that aren't zoned appropriately. Perhaps mm-hmm. industrial employment. They're sitting there. They've been sitting there for decades. That we through this commercial policy review, which I've been pushing hard at council, is to get staff to reevaluate how that roadway is zoned, because there are properties on that roadway that are large enough mm-hmm. to accommodate a commercial grocery store. And that was what my entire motion was about, was mm-hmm. that trying to speed that up when those, because I know that there has been interest. I've received phone calls from developers who are more than interested in doing something on York Road, but the commercial policy review has to be in place first.
Mm-hmm.
So my motion was simply to engage that process more actively. Let the development community know that we are listening and that we are open for business, and essentially get a plan B in place, regardless of what Loblaws does. I've said this, when they want to come to the table and build their store, which I know they've been very close a few times, when they're ready to build their store, I'm here to shake their hand. I'm here to work with them. It'll be a great project. But in the meantime, I don't like standing here with my hands open, wondering what's coming. I need to be working towards a solution.
Yeah, and you and Bob don't like having to tell people that it's, you know, this is having to explain Loblaws to your constituents.
You know, most people, I will say this, everyone gets it.
Yeah.
Everyone gets it. And they get why the motion, the whole word Loblaws came through that motion, and I never intended it to. There's nowhere in the motion do I mention a name. I don't like naming players in when I'm in the seat
right.
at City Hall. I don't think that's fair. But my motion was simply to pursue new commercial growth along York Road. Other people lobbed in Loblaws. But I think it turned out well. I think the community needs to see action, not just from me, but from City Hall as well. And quite frankly, I think that when we go to them, you know, we developed a trust contract with them when they elected us.
Mm-hmm.
And I refuse to sit back after 4 years and have anyone wonder, was I working towards something?
Yeah.
So
I get that.
It's important for the community to see that. And quite frankly, there's a million things going on in the background that I can't wait to share when it happens. But in the meantime,
so diplomatic.
Yeah. We don't want false expectations, right?
Super publics until then, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Super, still
Dan, unfortunately, we're out of time, but if people want to get in touch with you, how can they do that?
Oh, you know, Ward 1 Guelph is my brand, so ward1guelph.ca, Ward 1 Guelph on Facebook. I've changed my Twitter handle to Dan Gibson Counselor, CLLR, just to be a bit more personal. But, we're open for business. I love talking to people. My constituent hour every day is from 3 to 4:30 for anybody listening who wants to get a hold of me. I set that aside every single day for calls, so would love to hear from you.
Great, and thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us here, and we will love to have you back at some point. We'd love to have Bob on, too. We're trying
Absolutely.
To get Bob on.
You guys are great. I'm a big fan. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Just a reminder, a couple more program notes. We have Democracy Guelph. They'll be in studio next week at this time. And then on the 25th, we will have Ward 3 Councillor Phil Ault. He will be joining us then. Stay connected to us all week long at opensourcesguelph.com, OpenSources Newswire on Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on the Twitter feeds. And, of course, you can listen to this and all previous episodes of Open Sources Guelph on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can pick us up through iTunes or Stitcher. You can connect with me on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at a place called The Spanner Book.
And that is it for us this week. Stay tuned for DJ Sounds Good to Me here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And if it's 5 o'clock on Thursday, it is Open Sources, and we will see you then.